And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to Podcast UFO. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And as she just said, we are coming at you live on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And we're actually recording from a little mountaintop in Maine. Sounds really great, doesn't it? As always, we are here Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is 6 p.m. Pacific Time. And we have a great show for you tonight with guests Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte. And that's coming up. Before that, I have Andy Fleming talking about panspermia. And just was going through our Facebook page, and, you know, Peggy's always hard at work. And if you're over there in the chat room, I have to tell you, I may not be able to get on the chat room tonight. I'm having trouble with one of my computers. I got to hardwire it. The wireless is not working correctly. So you may not see myself in the chat room. I'm going to try to get on there so I can ask some questions. Please don't be discouraged. I will work on that as we go along here. I'll tell you what, as we're playing Andy Fleming's clip on astronomy, I'll do everything possible I can to get in the chat room. So if you're listening live at Dark Matter Radio Network, you can jump over to podcastufo.com. And on the right-hand sidebar, two clicks and you're in the chat room. And you can at least communicate with each other and complain like you usually do and have some fun. Dr. Harold Sonny White is still working on the warp drive or warp bubbles. This is on the news and the Facebook page. And I wanted to tell you, I actually wrote Sonny White an email, and he actually responded to me. This was a while back, and said, yes, indeed, the math has worked out for warp bubbles, and it was something to keep my eye on. I did email him back and ask him if he would be on a UFO show, and he very politely, very nicely declined. He just was not up for that. And, you know, I can't say as I blame him. He might get some ridicule from that. But anyway, at NASA's Johnson Space Center, his work on the experimental stage, but it doesn't mean we can imagine what the real-life Enterprise ship would look like, but he had a 3D concept artist, Mark Rademacher. He drew up these wonderful renditions of what a warp bubble vehicle may look like, and I believe we have the link to that in our show notes, and we'll have a picture or two up there. And so right now we have Andy Fleming coming up on panspermia.
And hello, Martin and listeners. Now, a couple of years ago at a local planetarium, I had the privilege of holding some pieces of Mars that had actually been found on the ice of Antarctica. Scientists know the origin of these NASA samples because the gases inside share the same composition of the gases in the Martian atmosphere. The meteorites were ejected from an impactor strike on the red planet. Now, this leads to some interesting speculation about whether life actually originated here on the Earth. Let's face it, while we search for extraterrestrial life, we still don't know for certain its terrestrial origins. What if instead of originating in pond scum, life hitched a ride here on a meteor? Now, this is the theory of panspermia, which in Greek means seeds everywhere. The seeds in this case would not only be the chemical building blocks of life, but also extremophile bacteria.
Well, folks, I'm not sure what happened, but I see this right now that the clip has ended prematurely at 1 minute and 17 seconds in. You know, we're going to have to go with this next week and not worry all that much about it. Sorry about that, Andy, if you're listening live over in the UK. This clip is corrupt. I just found out just now. So again, we'll get on that and play the full clip next week. And we are ready to bring on our guests. So pull up your chairs around the old computer and join in the chat room at Podcast UFO. And I was able to get on there. And gather around your computer, like I said, get yourself a hot spot of tea, and we're ready to talk with Noe and Ruben. How are you guys?
Hello there, Martin. This is Noe Torres, and I'm in South Texas on the Rio Grande River border with Mexico. And by the way, this has been a hot spot recently, not just temperature-wise, but lots of UFO sightings and incidents reported in this area, which we'll talk more about.
Wow. And Ruben, you on?
This is Ruben Uriarte calling from the San Francisco Bay Area on the East Bay, which was recently destroyed by Godzilla.
I missed that clip. I missed that. That should have been on our Facebook page. I don't know what happened. Yep.
Happy to be on your show and with Noe Torres, and we have a lot to share with your audience.
Oh, that's great. So one of the reasons I first contacted you, Noe, way back when, I think it was maybe perhaps, I don't know, 6 or 8 months ago, is what I think is called Mexico's Roswell. The military was involved. A plane collided with the UFO, supposedly, and this whole thing happened. And it's how do you pronounce the name of the town that happened in?
Well, this happened, it's associated with a tiny town in northern Mexico called Coyame,
right,
in the state of Chihuahua.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And so this is a fascinating case. And I have to tell you before we go on that I had Bill Burns, I know he was in UFO Hunters, and they explored that situation briefly on UFO Hunters. And while I had him on the show, I had someone on the Facebook page come forward and say they were part of the military that was there, and baited both. They may be listening, and that's okay, because they baited both Bill Burns and I for, oh, maybe a week or so afterward with all this information. And then after doing some thorough research, we were going to have a show about it and everything, have this guy on, because he was talking about aliens and everything else. Real exciting, groundbreaking. And when I found out he was born in 1964... it did not work.
Oh, no.
He would be awful young to be in the military at that point.
That's right. He would have been 10 years old when the incident happened.
And that's exactly what I said to him. I said, thank you for wasting our time.
And actually, Martin, we're coming up to 40 years now since the incident happened. And go ahead, Noe. Go ahead and
Well, actually, Ruben and I have worked so long and so closely together that I was going to say the very same thing, Ruben, that this year is the 40th anniversary of the so-called Mexico's Roswell case. And Ruben and I just put out a new book about this, by the way, called The Coyame Incident, UFO Crash Near Presidio, Texas. We gave a reference point to the crash in Texas because the mid-air collision between the small plane flying out of El Paso, Texas, and this unidentified flying object, which had come across the northern Mexico area from the Gulf of Mexico and had zigzagged all over northern Mexico before finally colliding with this plane. The point of the crash was actually just as close to the Texas side of the Rio Grande as it was to Coyame, the small town that we've referred to. So what we've, and this will be the third year that this has happened. Every year we have a gathering, a UFO festival, if you will, in the small town of Presidio, Texas. And to commemorate this incredible event that happened in 1974 that we'll be talking more at length about.
Okay, sure. So let's, for the listener that has never heard the whole incident, can you kind of give a soup to nuts, but not too involved in what happened there?
Sure. I'm going to start off, and then I'm going to let Ruben come in toward the tail end and provide some additional commentary. But the nuts and bolts of it is that back on August 25th, 1974, so we're 2 months away from the 40th anniversary, latter part of August, the 25th, there was a sighting of a strange object coming toward the Texas coast from out in the Gulf of Mexico. And it was moving fairly quickly and at a very high altitude. So the immediate thought was that perhaps this could be an incoming ICBM fired by a hostile nation. So we were looking at an object that was streaking toward us at over 2,500 miles per hour and an altitude of 75,000 feet, incoming to one of the largest port cities in South Texas, which is Corpus Christi. Suddenly, the object did a 90-degree angle turn to the south, and it zoomed down past Brownsville, Texas, again moving very fast, over 2,000 miles per hour, did another 90-degree angle turn and cut into Mexican airspace about 40 miles south of Brownsville, Texas, which is the southernmost tip of Texas. So a short while later, the object started decelerating and descending in a series of steps. In other words, it would fly at a certain altitude and speed for a while, and then it would plateau down to a lower level and at a slightly slower speed. And it seemed to follow more or less the course of the Rio Grande River, which divides Texas and Mexico, until it came to a point which is near the Texas town of Presidio and the Mexican town of Coyame on the other side of the river. And it was there that reportedly this UFO crashed into a small plane that had taken off about an hour earlier from El Paso International Airport, which is northwest of Presidio. And the two objects collided. The wreckage fell to the desert below, and that's where the story gets really interesting, because apparently there was a recovery effort made both by the U.S. and Mexico to get to the wreckage first and to retrieve whatever technology was to be found there. And the first ones to get to the scene were actually a team of Mexican soldiers, along with a convoy of military vehicles, flatbed truck. They actually got to the wreckage of the small plane. They saw that there was not much left, and there certainly weren't any survivors. This was the following morning after the crash. But then near the crashed plane, they found this silver disc, and it was kind of small in terms of UFO encounters of the past. It was 16 feet in diameter and about 7 or 8 feet tall. But anyway, they found this silver disc, and it was more or less intact. It had a couple of damage points on the hull. But they hoisted it up into their military truck, and they headed back to the Army base in that's right along the border with Texas there in Ojinaga, Chihuahua, which is, I mean, you can walk from Ojinaga over to Presidio in just a matter of minutes. Ruben and I have made that trip across that border many times. But anyway, on the way to Ojinaga, something really interesting happened, and that is that the entire convoy of between 20 and 30 Mexican soldiers stopped dead in its tracks, and all the soldiers died. They were found later when the U.S. recovery team arrived shortly thereafter. As I mentioned, both were trying to get to the wreckage. The Mexican team got there first. They had the advantage of geography. But when the U.S. team arrived in biohazard gear, full protection suits, which the Mexicans did not have, prior experience in handling these sorts of incidents, of course, favored the U.S. recovery effort. So they arrived at the scene. They found the Mexicans dead, and they actually took control of that crashed UFO and brought it back to the state of Texas. So in a nutshell, that gives you an overview of the happenings of that day in August 1974.
Now, were there any witnesses that actually saw any part of the crash besides on radar?
Well, yeah, we have, I'll let Ruben speak to that, but some very interesting witnesses have come forward. Go ahead, Ruben.
Yes, as Noe even mentioned, it's been close to 40 years, and you know, the fact how we found out about this particular case was through a document known as the Deneb Report. This is how Noe and I first got involved in it, because originally there was a television documentary that was being put together by History Channel, and they were looking at different crash retrievals, and this particular document came up. And when Noe saw the episode, and I was in the documentary talking briefly about the incident that happened in Koyame, Noe later contacted me and said, "Hey, where did you get this document? I'm familiar with Texas. I'm familiar with the geography. This is so well detailed. It was so well written. There's just a lot more to it." So with that, as we started to gather all the different types of information, we realized that there's so much more detail. And that's when Noe had said, "Hey, let's collaborate and do a book on this." And Martin, I wouldn't believe it. Just led on to something bigger, because what we found was that there were other UFO crashes that have occurred on the Texas-Mexican border, which that could lead to other later on other interviews with on your show, because there's just so much that we were finding out. But the thing that's been really quite unique is, as we've been putting together these conferences, as Noe had mentioned, the one in Presidio, slowly but surely we've been luring several witnesses. People have, there was a couple that a mother and a son. She was a former school teacher and retired. And back in 1974, they remember seeing this huge explosion on the other side of the Mexican border. There's probably some other little details there, but. Well, then we also received some other eyewitness testimony from a gentleman who is a Los Angeles police officer. In fact, then his family were visiting Koyame, since they had family there, and he shared with us a strange story about him encountering an alien, being. Right around the same time that the Koyame incident had occurred. So there's a lot more to the story that we, after 40 years, just like with the Roswell incident, it happened in 1947, and we're still learning bits and pieces from other witnesses that are sharing information with the various investigators.
Now, has anyone in the military, on either the Mexican side or the U.S. side, has anyone spoken up as a witness that was legitimate?
We have a report from a gentleman who, and I want to backtrack just a little bit. The mobilization effort on the U.S. side was staged out of Fort Bliss Army Base, which is one of the largest U.S. Army installations in the United States, based in El Paso, Texas. And actually, their territory extends from El Paso, Texas, all the way into New Mexico. It is a huge military compound. So according to the information that we've gathered, the military hardware that was used, which was six helicopters, including a huge cargo helicopter, the military hardware was assets were brought into Fort Bliss, you know, in the dead of night, upon having received the information of a fallen angel, as it's referred to oftentimes in as a code word. So this hardware was brought into place. The personnel were brought in on a moment's notice from all over the U.S., and so the staging of it was out of Fort Bliss. Well, we have had a witness who was at Fort Bliss in 1974, and he told us that he was a young man. His dad was in the military, and he used to ride his motorbike around the base. And he noticed a high level of security and lots of mobilization of vehicles and personnel in August 1974. He's not completely exactly sure of the date, but he thought this was extremely unusual and had never seen anything like it prior to that day and hadn't seen anything after that day. So we've had all of these witnesses. Backing up just a moment, the Chambers story, John Chambers and his mother, who was a very respected and award-winning teacher in the state of Texas, they were the ones who were on the Texas side the night this happened, and they saw this huge explosion, almost like a mushroom cloud, come up over the mountains of Mexico, right across the river from the Presidio, Texas area. And what's really, really odd about that is that years before we heard from them, Ruben and I had pinpointed what we thought was the more or less exact location of this mid-air collision between the plane and the UFO. And so we had drawn an X on the map, so to speak, on the Mexican side of the international boundary. And what really blew our minds was when John Chambers and his mom came forward and said they saw the explosion, and it came, the smoke rose right up from the very point that Ruben and I had drawn on the map 2 or 3 years earlier. So that just, it gave me goosebumps when we finally realized that they were talking about having seen that right on the other side of that mountain range. And Ruben and I have been all throughout walking around that area on the Mexican side. So we were actually looking at that mountain from the other side, from the Mexico side, when we were doing our research. And she was talking about her and her son having seen the incident from the Texas side on that evening. So it was an eerie and uncanny experience.
Well, now, when the Mexicans died, had any research or anything come about as far as what killed them? As far, do you know any of that information?
So far, well, in the report, as it was mentioned, that these soldiers supposedly died or were exposed to some sort of biological toxic substance, which we were always speculating that perhaps that's what it was, a virus of some sort that threatened not just the soldiers or that area, but the entire area. And that perhaps is one of the reasons why that huge explosion might have been the reason for the quarantine that was imposed. In the report, they gathered all the soldiers, they gathered the vehicles, all, and they went ahead and destroyed them. But as far as anything else, there's been some theories we hear about that perhaps these soldiers, the Mexican soldiers, might have died from a encounter with the with the U.S. military. But again, that's just right. Speculation, and we are looking at different sources. So if we're able to pull that up, if that is true, then we really are dealing with an international incident of far, great proportions that definitely shows that we have a major cover-up.
Right, right. Another thing that always crosses my mind, you said there may have been other crashes. If you had to, I don't care if it's either you, Noe, or Ruben, want to speculate, or both of you, where the heck would they put something that was retrieved? What would you think they would do with it?
Okay, well, regarding other crashes, I just want to add that that area of Mexico, which is part of the Chihuahuan Desert, which also extends, by the way, into the United States and up to Roswell, New Mexico. That's a northernmost extension of the Chihuahuan Desert, which actually begins just a little north of Mexico City and extends all the way into Roswell. So, I mean, what's really interesting is that this has been an incredibly active area in terms of UFO sightings, encounters with beings, paranormal events. There's an area there near Presidio, Texas, that's known as Mexico's Zone of Silence or Mexico's Bermuda Triangle. Compasses don't work. Electronics don't function. Aviators have had trouble controlling their planes. So for whatever reason, that area of of West Texas and northern Mexico is incredibly active with paranormal activity and continues to be so today. We're not exactly sure what may have happened to the retrieved artifacts from the Koyamak crash. The Deneb report, which Ruben has referenced, which was the original source for this reported UFO crash, the Deneb document mentions that the crash artifacts were taken to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. Which is logical because in 1974, that was the world's most advanced laboratories facility for dealing with possible lethal biological contamination, elements of biological contamination. So that's another, you can kind of notch that on the side of this was an event which threatened some deadly biological consequences for both the U.S. and Mexico side, and perhaps that's why what happened, namely the death of the Mexican soldiers, the recovery by the U.S. of the materials, and then ship them off to the Centers for Disease Control. After, however, that wasn't the final destination, according to the Deneb report and other information we've looked at. Apparently, it went from the Centers of for Disease Control in Atlanta, went to a secret military installation, the identity of which would just be us speculating.
Well, yes. You know, I was just looking up on the message board. You're welcome. If you're on the message board, if you want to pose a question to our guest tonight, please go right ahead and do so, and I'll read the question to them. So the thing that it makes total sense is if something did come from, say, another planet, and it was just simply in contact with humans, of course there could be a biological sickness immediately and even deadly. That makes total sense, just like the opposite of the War of the Worlds, you know, when you know, the beings died of our simple colds or diseases. You know, we don't have, I think there's something like, I forget how many billions of things we're immune to, but it's all evolution. You get instantaneously exposed to something that your body does not have any defense against and certainly could kill someone right away.
Ironically, you probably remember the movie The Andromeda Strain.
Oh, yes.
Made in 1971.
Great movie.
Which was film not too far from Presidio. Every time that I go with Noe, what is the name of that little town again, Noe? Shafter, or is it?
It's Shafter, Texas, and it's actually one of the richest silver mining areas in the state of Texas over history. And just recently, a Canadian company has come in and reactivated the mines, which had been closed for decades. But it's interesting that a lot of UFO incidents tend to happen in areas that are rich in certain kinds of ores. And certainly the area there around Presidio Coyame is one of the wealthiest in terms of ore deposits, silver and other kinds of ores.
Yeah.
Ores. It's one of the richest uranium. It's one of the richest uranium mining areas in all of the country of Mexico. So, I mean, we don't know if that's associated with it, but there certainly seems to be, looking at the long history of UFO sightings, there does seem to be a correlation between the presence of certain ores in large quantities and these sightings.
Yes.
Also, just to add, too, you also have another area that's very famous for its sightings, and that's the Marfa Lights. That's another one of my favorite places I love to travel, which is not that far from that area. Are you pretty familiar with that, are you, Martin?
What's it called again? I'm sorry?
The Marfa Lights.
I think that came up before, but I don't know. I'm going to talk about something else, though. But
okay.
Where is that quickly?
Well, I'm going to fill in, if I could, just briefly, Martin. As I mentioned, that whole area is like a paranormal treasure trove. It's one of the reasons that we decided to have this annual conference there, because there's so many interesting things. And one of those, it's like seeing UFOs every night on schedule, because at dusk, since the 1800s, you stand at a certain place in the small town of Marfa, Texas. You can stand in a certain place and look out on the desert floor about 10 to 20 miles ahead of you, and up against the side of a mountain ridge, you can see these incredibly bizarre twinkling lights moving up and down, spinning around in circles, changing colors, and all kinds of scientific tests have been done trying to explain them away as some kind of natural phenomenon. Nobody has been able to adequately explain them. Other people say they're the lights, headlights from cars that are passing by nearby roads that are reflected up into the clouds and back down. All kinds of weird theories that are even stranger in some ways than just calling them UFOs or calling them unexplained. The problem with the car theory is that those lights have been around since the 1800s, and there were no cars in the 1800s. So it's a strange phenomenon. It just goes with that whole region where this UFO crash incident happened.
You know, recently I was speaking about the hotspot over in Denmark, where there's actually, you know, there's been a little bit of scientific work, and there's speculation among scientists that actually looked into that seriously, that because there's copper deposits or I can't remember what else there was there. But they're speculating that it might be almost like a battery effect and causing like a natural phenomenon of plasma lights, which would make sense in a lot of situations. But when you're talking about there are areas that are hotspots, that there's all kinds of paranormal things going on that can't really be linked to battery-type conditions or plasma or anything like that.
Now, here's another interesting twist to this, Martin, is last year, Ruben and I were present when this was taking place. We had a group of paranormal researchers that were using handheld laser beams, laser emitters, and they aimed it at those Marfa lights off in the distance, and those things would, there was a definite reaction. We caught it on film. When the laser beam would strike those orbs of light, they would slowly diminish in size and go out. Then as soon as the researchers turned the laser beam off, they'd come back on. And in some cases, they would move left in a clear reaction to the laser beam, or they would move right. And Ruben and I were just amazed, because previous to that, nobody had ever tried any sort of a laser beam experiment. And by the way, that was such a big story that it was featured on the front page of the San Antonio, Texas major newspaper, the San Antonio Express News, the next day. So, I mean, we're talking about something that people are really interested in. It's been a mystery that's been around Texas since the 1800s, as I mentioned.
Yes. Where can someone find that film?
It's on our YouTube site, which is linked from our website, roswellbooks.com. It's kind of a one-stop shop for everything. So people will just look up roswellbooks.com, or they can also go to YouTube and just do some searches for Marfa Lights Laser Experiment.
Wow, that's great. I'm going to have to check that out myself.
And Marfa is Marfa, by the way.
Okay, we will link that to our show notes, or we'll have that link to the podcast.
Well, I'll send you a link, Martin, so you can share with your listeners.
All right. Now, when we spoke briefly ahead of time, you said that there have been a couple of breakthroughs continuing on, talking about the Kayame crash. Can you explain to the listening audience what those breakthroughs have been?
Well, one of the major breakthroughs we've already touched on was coming across the incredible story that John Chambers and his mother, Mrs. Chambers, a renowned Texas educator with over 50 years of experience. When they came forward and told us that they saw what we said they should have seen, but they saw it from the Texas side up where this incident happened. And then also Ruben has a very interesting story that he heard from a police officer in L.A. who grew up in Coyame and was there when the incident happened. Ruben, do you want to tell briefly what the officer told you?
Yes, and go into a little bit more detail, but what he was sharing with us, which we also now included in our book, was the fact that during the summertime, his family, they would visit the grandparents that lived in Coyame, and one day he was riding his uncle's horse, and when he was riding it, it was getting very dark, so he dismounted and started to take care of the horse, and right across the road from the corral, there was a cornfield, and he kept looking and because he heard a noise, and he kept looking over there. And finally, he looked again, and he saw this shadowy figure, and he thought it was an animal. But when he looked again, he said, "Oh, it looked like a small man." Well, when he stared at it, and then he noticed that this thing was a small humanoid-like creature, that it had very deep red eyes, and that the face or the forehead of the skull of the creature had these ridges. And it just frightened the heck out of him, so he ran to his grandmother's house and started telling everybody what he saw. And then his grandmother said, "Oh, you must have seen the devils." And that's how, because the grandmother and some of the local people have seen these type of beings there in that area. Years later, we've been in contact and working very closely with several other Mexican investigators, and they had shared with us that their witnesses had seen these similar type beings, which coincidentally almost matches the description of these beings that were seen in Brazil. If you recall the Guyana case, yes, that's what shocked him. He saw drawings, our witness said he saw the drawings of that particular being in Brazil, and he said that's exactly what he saw.
Wow.
So we might be on to something there. I think also, I think we may have covered this, but in terms of the military, we did get somebody that went into our Wikipedia and added the names of soldiers. They added the names of the Mexican soldiers that were dead, as well as the American soldiers that were involved in the actual retrieval. We thought that was really interesting. And so Noe went and was doing some investigation and trying to find out the source of that, which he Noe, I was just wondering if you wanted to elaborate on that.
This was a very interesting development, Martin, that happened to us. I wrote the original article for Wikipedia. For those of your listeners, and there shouldn't be too many who aren't familiar with it, it's an encyclopedia on the internet that anyone can post information to, and you can go in and edit other people's articles if you want to. It's kind of a shared community encyclopedia of all the world's knowledge. It strives to be. So I had written an article many years ago, I'd say around 2007, just giving a brief overview of the Coyame incident as Ruben and I have brought it to your listeners tonight. Well, about a year ago, suddenly the basic outline of what happened was changed by an anonymous user on Wikipedia's website. And they went in, as Ruben said, and they filled in where we had said that some Mexican soldiers died. They went in and filled in the names and Mexican military serial numbers of some of the Mexican soldiers who died. And Now, this will blow your mind. They also added the names and military serial numbers for several of the U.S. soldiers involved in the recovery effort. Not only that, but they went in and added more details which make sense in the overall scheme of the story, but they weren't details that we had any source for or any confirmation about. So I tried to work through the people, you know, and Wikipedia is an all-volunteer effort made up of people from all over the world. I tried to work through the Wikipedia hierarchy, trying to figure out who it was that posted that article. When I finally was able to communicate with the individual who posted that, he was very evasive. He would not respond to my emails. He ignored my questions. He gave me answers which were misleading about where he got the information. When I would check his sources, there was no such information at those sources. And finally, he just said something to the effect that he no longer wished to talk to me, and he cut off all communications. So we don't know. He was obviously a person who had inside information, may have been involved in the case or known someone who was involved in the case. And so that is a story that is still, we're still looking into, and there's a lot of unanswered questions there, but it's very intriguing.
Were you ever able to verify any of the numbers at all?
We had what we thought was some verification from our Mexican UFO investigator friends who were looking into the soldiers named as having died in the incident. And we had some preliminary information that individuals who were serving in the Mexican military in August 1974 did in fact perish at that time. However, all of that is preliminary, and we're not really prepared to say with certainty. They're still looking up death records. This is a very recent development. It's just been known to us for a few months. And so, as I say, it's ongoing, and we hope to have more about that very soon.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is like another Roswell. I mean, the investigations of it are going to keep going on, and I hope you too stay on this, because you know, it seems like you are getting somewhere on it, and you know, it's the same thing with Roswell. I mean, a lot of different investigators. Someone may come along, you know, after so many years and take over from where you guys are standing. But it's one of these cases that, you know, it needs to keep unfolding.
Well, you know, the comparison to Roswell is extremely valid, because it took many, many years before the truth about Roswell finally started to come out. You know, Roswell happened in 1947, and the first book about it, the research for which was done primarily by Stanton Friedman, was published in 1980, which was the Roswell incident by Berlitz. And so, I mean, it took, how long is it from 1947 to 1980? That's, you know, that's a really long time. That's
what's
30. So anyway, we're approaching that same period of time now with the Koyama case. People have retired from the military. They're feeling a little bit freer to speak about their experience. We had, and I meant to mention earlier, but we just recently had contact through our Facebook page from a young lady who says that her uncle was involved in the U.S. military and was ordered to go to Mexico's Roswell. He went, came back, and was never the same. She posted on our Facebook page. She claimed that her dad was involved with the U.S. military retrieval of the crashed UFO near Koyama in 1974. And unfortunately, when I attempted to meet with her or question her further, she did not feel free to continue the dialogue. So that's another kind of loose end. Yeah. That we're going to try to follow up on. But She seemed very earnest and sincere, and she put it in writing when she first approached me with it, so...
Wow. Well, you can tell, if anyone just heard what I just said, you can tell that I'm just had a six-hour commute today. I just said, oh, yeah, 53 years instead of 33 years. My math is doing really good tonight. So
well, I heard 33. I think
oh, yeah, it was 33, yeah. I have the power of editing, too. I'll go back. As time moves on, you know, you guys come out with this book. You get an extra witness or two out of it. That's what seems to happen a lot of times when there's TV shows,
yes,
documentaries, or books come out. People, the word gets out more. People watch it or they read it, and they're ready to come forward. And there may be a percentage that may be a little BS, but when you're talking about this teacher, that sounds pretty legitimate. Have you had anyone come forward that you just didn't believe, like I mentioned earlier? The military person that contacted me?
We haven't, you know, everybody we've talked to has been extremely sincere. There's been a few strange birds that have communicated with us by email after we've done, for example, the Coast to Coast AM show or mm-hmm. one of those major shows. You always get, a lot of times you'll get some strange contacts from that. Commander Volkeen from the planet Arcturus or something like that. You know,
yeah.
But, you know, different strokes for different folks. No, we really haven't had anybody, unless Ruben, you might remember differently, but we haven't really pursued any leads that have been totally false.
Yeah, we really haven't been led astray too much. Most of the people have shared some valuable information. And one of the things that we're doing, and Noe had mentioned the Presidio conference, and this is the way what we're trying to do by putting together these conferences along in Texas. We've had several of them. This is one way of hopefully we might be able to get local testimony, and we just may get that big break. And that's how Stanton Friedman, if I recall, he came across his major contact with Mr. Jesse Marcel through another gentleman that he happened to meet at the gas station, and the gas attendant told him, "Oh, you got to meet Jesse Marcel," and that just opened up the doors for Stanton Friedman.
That was actually at a radio station, but yes, yeah.
So this is what we're hoping, and that we'll be able to entice and meet other people, and we meet people who've had, of course, their own experiences that they share with us. So it's happening all over the world, but we sure is concentrated in the Southwest.
Right. Now, you mentioned, Noe, we were talking earlier on, and you mentioned that you wanted to kind of announce something else. Go ahead, if you'd like.
Well, Ruben and I are extremely gratified. For the past 5 or 6 years, we've been working with towns here in Texas to kind of promote tourism and also bring more focus on the whole UFO issue. So we have actually been working with towns in Texas to promote UFO festivals. And when we say festivals, we're primarily trying to make these educational experiences. And as Ruben just said, we want to also provide a forum for people to speak up about sightings that they have experienced or that someone close to them has. And this has been very successful for us. At the same time, in addition to being educational and providing a safe environment where people can talk about their own experiences, we also inject some fun into it. And, you know, we'll usually have the local organizers, such as the Chamber of Commerce folks and others, plan some fun events for the whole family. So we have cookouts, we have costume contests. We try to make it kind of a Roswell UFO festival environment, which is where we obviously took the idea. So it was kind of like bringing the whole atmosphere, and a lot of your listeners have probably been to Roswell in the summer for their big annual festival, which is the largest such festival in the world, commemorating a UFO event. So we're trying to bring some of that Roswell atmosphere here to Texas, and we keyed on the spots in Texas where major UFO incidents have happened, such as Presidio, where the case that we're talking about tonight happened. Mm-hmm. Edinburgh, Texas, which is my hometown, is where I'm talking to you from tonight. We've got a big festival that launches on Friday, just in 2 days. We've got Kevin Randall, who is probably one of the world's foremost authorities. He is one of the world's foremost authorities on the Roswell UFO crash, has written over 100 books. He's our featured speaker, Kathleen Marden, who is the niece of Betty Hill. Again, one of the most famous UFO stories in the world, the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill in 1964. They're coming down and speaking along with a whole other range of speakers. So just this week, one of the major magazines, monthly magazines in the state of Texas, Texas Observer, wrote up a 5-page article on Ruben and my efforts to promote tourism in the state of Texas by holding these UFO festivals, for which we are very gratified. The article is titled, very catchy title, Aliens Without Borders. And it was written by a fine young staff writer with the Texas Observer named Patrick Michaels. And basically, he went and spent the entire weekend of the UFO festival we had this past January in Del Rio, Texas. He spent the entire weekend with us. He interviewed Stanton Friedman, Travis Walton. He interviewed Ruben. He interviewed me. And a lot of the festival goers, just people in general. And it's really a brilliant piece. And it talks about how Ruben and I, in his opinion, have succeeded in blending the fun elements, the family-friendly environment of, you know, enjoying the idea, the appeal of enjoying the possibility that life could exist elsewhere and may have even visited the Earth in the past. And blending that with the notion of educating people on the reality of UFO encounters, which are still going on today all around us. So we were very gratified. We were very happy that this article was just released. And Ruben has been kidding me nonstop because the writer of the article refers to me as the godfather of Texas UFO festivals. Now, that's a direct quote. And you know how applicable that is, I don't know, but it sure is fun. I've gotten a lot of ribbing over that, but that's okay. It was a really good article.
Now, how did you two meet? Was it you mentioned how you met, but you've written how many books together now?
Ruben and I have written 4 books together. We've had a delightful partnership going. Yeah. We also get together quite often and appear together at conferences. We spoke together at the Del Rio UFO Festival in this past January, and we're going to be speaking in Presidio at the annual conference that we've mentioned a couple of times in October 25th.
And we're also going to be speaking in Los Angeles in July. That's coming up very shortly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you want to, we just have a couple minutes left. So, excuse me, if you want to just go quickly over to the different books that you've written.
All right. Well, Ruben and I have actually, you know, it all started with Mexico's Roswell. That's the title of our first book. And we kind of titled it that because that's what the documentary on the History Channel, the original documentary, was called. As Ruben mentioned, the History Channel was doing a series of shows about Roswell-like incidents that occurred in other countries, and one of them was Mexico's Roswell, which was a Coyame case. It actually happened as close to Texas as it did to Coyame, so as we mentioned. Our second book arose from the first one, is that we kept hearing about another crash retrieval along the Texas-Mexico border, but much earlier. And we actually found the Air Force pilot who chased the UFO and saw it crash land near Del Rio, Texas. So our second book, called The Other Roswell, UFO Crash on the Texas-Mexico Border, actually kind of eventually led around to the UFO festival that we hold every year now in Del Rio, Texas. Mm-hmm. And so then Ruben and I also did a second edition where we revised Mexico's Roswell, and we corrected it, and we updated it, and we added additional chapters. And then we did a book about a very famous and little-known case that's very similar to Travis Walton's encounter, but with some strange elements that as I say, aren't widely known. That was our book, Aliens in the Forest, which we released a couple of years ago and has been wildly successful, and we've gotten some really good reviews on it. And we still speak about that book quite often. We'll have to come back and do another show with you about it. And our latest book is called The Coyame Incident, and it revisits the Mexico's Roswell case with all the new witnesses and new information that we talked about today, including the mystery of the sudden postings on Wikipedia, the story of the police officer who saw an alien step out of a cornfield in Coyame, and the John Chambers and Mrs. Chambers telling their story of what they saw on the night of August 1974.
Well, great. And your website is roswellbooks.com.
That's correct.
All right.
And very much appreciate you having us on.
It's been wonderful, and we will have you back for sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you again very much, Martin, and for having us.
You bet. So, well, that's it for our show today. And if you missed any part of this show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Also, you can check out the links and stories in our show notes. And I do apologize for Andy's clip. He'll be back next week with that one. And our next week's guest will be Roger Marsh. I want to thank everyone for helping out with our show today. Our two guests, of course, Noe Rubin and Keith Rowland, producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network. Andy Fleming, again, he'll be back. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. You can check us out live right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in the chat room at Podcast UFO. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky. And we'll see you next week.